somewhere. In introducing my dear friend, Dr. Walter Forster, I'm inclined to say that a prophet has returned to our campus. Dr. Forster was working very, very assiduously in research on our campus some more than 30 years ago. And as we were comparing notes this morning, I found out that he had never been invited back to speak to our faculty and students since the period of the 1940s. He was back on one occasion, and that was in 1953, when the first edition of Zion on the Mississippi was published, when with Concordia Publishing House, we conducted one of Concordia Publishing House's first autographing parties on this campus. I think that probably close to 1,000 copies of Zion on the Mississippi were sold at that particular occasion. And I think that speaks volumes of the caliber of the work that Dr. Forster has been doing. The research which he has conducted into the early history of the Missouri Synod, and more specifically into the immigration which took place in 1838 and 1839, forming the nucleus of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, has become indeed a classic. In fact, it has become such a sought-after volume that Concordia, within the last year, republished the book as part of its Concordia Heritage series. And if you do not have a copy, I would suggest that you raid the bookstore and obtain a copy before Dr. Forster leaves this campus, so that you might have him autograph it. One of my most cherished and prized books in my collection is an autographed copy of the first edition, in which he said more than anyone else has ever said about me, for which I am extremely grateful. I think that we really must rate Dr. Forster as the greatest scholar who has ever researched Missouri Synod history. And as you think in terms of those volumes that you may have read, those volumes that you have put on your reading list for some time in the future, this too is saying very much. There is one thing about this particular book that I think is probably as unique as the content, and that is the inscription which Dr. Forster put into the page after the title page, and I want to read it to you. It is "To Lydia, sine qua non." This is one of the kindest, one of the sweetest things that I think any author can say about his beloved spouse. And we are very fortunate to have Mrs. Forster with us this morning. I wonder if you could just rise for a second so everybody can see you. One who has really been a helpmeet, also in historical research, I should add, in many different capacities. The flyer which you have received gave you quite a bit of the background and the service record of our speaker this morning. However, there are a few things that I would very much like to highlight, one of which is the fact that Dr. Walter Forster was one of the first students of Concordia Seminary who did intensive work in historical research in Washington University, where he obtained his Doctor of Philosophy degree even before some of you were born. And through that contact with Washington University and its distinguished faculty, a new relationship has been established between these two institutions, which are so close to one another geographically. Because it is through the scholarly and the effective and brilliant work which Dr. Forster did in the Department of History at Washington University, that our students were increasingly accepted even before accreditation. Our credits were accepted over there as a sister institution because of the work which this gentleman had done. And I think that we owe him a lot also for that particular trailblazing. Dr. Forster is an individual who I think is somewhat comparable to the law professor who was telling his class that he said, if you have the facts on your side, then you hammer them into the jury. If you have the law on your side, you hammer it into the judge. And immediately one of the students piped up and he said, if you don't have either, then what do you do? And the law professor immediately said, then you hammer it into the table. Dr. Forster is an individual who has been capable of doing all three, not by necessity. Whenever he has written, and his list of writings is rather lengthy, he has always had the facts on his side. And anyone who would want to doubt that should take a look, a good, critical, careful look, particularly at Zion on the Mississippi. He has always had the law, which is the historiography, on his side. He has made use of the best of the principles of historical research. But Dr. Forster has also been a very, very impressive orator. So I think it is one of our greatest privileges to have with us this morning one of the most distinguished members of the historical craft in America, Dr. Walter O. Forster.
Dr. Silflow, esteemed members of the faculty, students, and friends, I'm delighted after many years to be back in my hometown and on this campus where I can still count a classmate in Dr. Charlemagne, a few old friends, John Klotz, Dr. Silflow, both Silflows, Art Freiman. Dr. Silflow's introduction was generous beyond the line of duty, but I shan't reject a word of it. Not being one of those luminaries who requires no introduction, I'm going to accept all the introduction I can get. Yet even a welcome so warm as this and a return to environs so warmly remembered cannot entirely dispel a certain feeling of unnaturalness about the experience of returning to the scene of my early indiscretions. Dr. Silflow cited one of these, namely my foray into the research on the activities of our spiritual forebears, or perhaps in the case of some of you, your biological forebears. It was natural that he should do so, since it is the principal, perhaps the only point of contact for the most of you, between you and me. But the appreciative tone of his references is what attracted my attention. With a single exception of him and his cohorts at the Institute, I am not used to such a response in these parts. It stands in sharp contrast to the acerbic reaction to my activities expressed by a former manager of Concordia Publishing House when he first caught wind of my design for Les Majestés. The crusty old Missouri Synod loyalist snorted. He snorted in German, and I transnort freely. Grass grows over a story like that, and then some jackass comes along and crops it all off again. It was typical, and not only of him. The uncomplimentary metaphor of which I was the object in that pontifical put-down didn't trouble me very much, especially does it not now, as the lengthening retrospect on my misspent years leads me to a considerable degree of agreement. But as for his regrets over the unwelcome exposure created by my attentat on synodical mythology, I suppose that by now grass had grown over that publishing venture as well, and that no one would turn the sod. Well, certainly, considering the official reactions to it at the time, I'm at a loss to explain why resentments should now be refueled, so you can understand my astonishment on learning from Dr. Soflow that a reprint has appeared. This is the first notification I have received on the subject. That's true. As usual, the betrayed partner is the last to know. And of course, they never understand, so I shall not even ask why. However, we cannot entirely avoid mention of the emigration, since this convocation is intended as an observance of one episode in that story. At that, in turn, I'm sure that that's what brought me to mind. It seems that the Saxons and I are locked in a kind of tar-baby embrace. Mrs. Silflow, is she here? Gladys, I hope you'll forgive my old-fashioned form of address. To me, MS still stands for manuscript, and ERA for earned run average. Mrs. Silflow explained to me from the outset that this was the rationale for summoning me before you, the landing 140 years ago of the last contingent of the Saxon immigrants in St. Louis. The reminder was greatly appreciated, since this significant and important anniversary had slipped from my memory and off the pages of my date book. But all I know, more correctly knew, about the Saxon immigration is what I read, that is, more correctly read, in my little story about them. That I have forgotten enough so that more recent readers probably are better informed than am I. Allow me to stress for a moment that I have been invited to speak to you as an historian and a subject of my choice. It was very generous of you to grant me an hour of your time, although perhaps a bit indiscreet not to assign a topic. For left to my own devices, not unnaturally, that topic turns out to be history. That is my field, as yours presumably is theology. Now, in the latter, I do not qualify, for not even a diploma from Concordia Seminary confers an indelible character on the recipient. How, then, shall these two communicate? I think that they do so best when each most unapologetically remains itself, and least arrogantly presumes to displace or subjugate the other. Mixing the disciplines of history and theology always makes me stir uneasily, not because they have nothing to say to one another, but because I have difficulty in following the dialogue if they both try to speak at the same time. Thus, I become suspicious when I see in seminary catalogs, that's right, including yours, an area of study called historical theology. Now, in some cases, the brief course description sounds reassuringly like honest-to-God history, but in others, not. Some, frankly, are devoted to a history of theology. All right, that kind of construct I have finally learned out of sheer impotence to tolerate, after years of chafing at all manner of histories of, usually not taught by historians. Thus, there are histories of everything from war to wallpaper and from marketing to music. You would not believe me if I told you that in a recent issue of the Journal of American History, it carried reviews in succession of presumably historical treatments of Welch's Grape Juice, Butch Cassidy, and Kenosha County. Still other phases of the historical theology, one suspects, ought in all candor to be entitled theological history. Now, I don't know whether that is avoided because it would be too obviously ein Unding. Perhaps not. Perhaps it is that kind of history that is to be deferred to a future when you have your own pulpit and can introduce your most impressive observations on human affairs with that briefest, most authoritative, and most abused of principal clauses, history teaches. Well, history can teach, and some it does. One catch is that frequently what they learn bears a striking resemblance to the premises with which they presumed as learners to approach the subject. Against this deception, I must issue a stern warning. Anyone who does this is bent on informing history, not learning from it. I also strongly object to usurping the name of historian by purporting to talk about history while expounding a philosophy or a theology. From the pretensions of philosophers, I have learned much about what they think history should say, but not much about what it says. In this cluster of esoterics, the former, what they think, invariably takes precedence over the latter, what history has to teach. I am aware that they're using the term in a different sense, but that does not make the depreciation of history any the more welcome. When I speak to you of history, I'm using the term in its pristine, pedestrian, mundane sense, appropriate to my talents and understanding. I shall avoid talk about the philosophy or the theology of history, for I am neither. Sure enough, among the history of crowd, a fair number finally get down to the role of religion in history, including Christianity. Well, at that point, I join up with the Christians and try with the boldest mien I can manage to face the lions, but not in alliance with the theologians of history. For I am convinced of my religious beliefs, not because history persuades me, but because the Holy Spirit has. If he had not been operative in me, I am bound to say that I never would have accepted what I now know. History is, or should be, a scholarly enterprise. And no scholarship ever demonstrated the incarnation, the deity of the historical Jesus, man's redemption through him, or the inevitability of the second coming. I once drew outraged criticism from a pastoral conference, for which I was asked to give an historical paper. By negotiating the full length of my discourse, without once observing about any event mentioned, that it demonstrated the hand of God in history. And I stirred up a veritable storm by replying that such an obiter dictum was not an historical but a theological statement. It might indeed be true, but the perspective it featured was supplied by faith, not by scholarship. So if this distinction is not yet clear in your mind, I recommend it for your careful consideration. History and theology are not the same. And I offer the pledge, whether you welcome it or not, that I shall not attempt to concoct an intellectual fricassee of the two. Condemned to repeat it. For starters, take the statement from which I excerpted the heading for these remarks. Few aphorisms about history are as frequently quoted, though variously attributed, as the portentous announcement that those who ignore history are condemned to repeat it. Now, the simple proposition that we had better learn from the experience of the past or bear the consequences is acceptable enough. Usually, the warning is a form which is in which it here appears is mobilized by those who wish to induce greater attention to history, among others who display insufficient appreciation of it. Thus, it becomes a sort of threat. History will get you if you don't watch out. A kind of companion piece to Bismarck's sardonic remark that only a fool learns from his mistakes. A wise man learns from the mistakes of others. Like most such pronouncements, the one that constitutes our heading is badly flawed. Even granting that winged words bearing capsulized wisdom should not be examined as closely as the message which they convey, it is interesting to see what this message reveals about those who would fully subscribe to it. I'll take a moment or two for that, but most of all, while I'm doing it, watch out, and watch out later. How we use our history tells us something about us. Now, does history, in fact, repeat itself? Well, I think that most historians would dissent, leaving the cyclical view of history to the ancients, and perhaps in one form to Oswald Spengler. Indeed, the majority would likely prefer to argue the contrary proposition, that history cannot be made to repeat itself even if you try. Equally debatable is the grim view of the past that regards repetition of any part of history, were that possible, as a sentence pronounced upon the condemned. Such a harsh judgment on all that has gone before surpasses in the negative the labors of the architects of mythological golden ages. A verdict so categorical must be predicated upon a misanthropy which views as a disaster all experience at any given moment. Now watch this. Even that which has learned from history, but has now become history itself. At the same time, although negative in form, the assertion is highly positive in its postulate. It invites a questionable optimism with its implicit confidence that man, in fact, does use a rational approach to his problems and can thereby improve his condition by avoiding earlier errors, always, of course, overlooking the possibility of inventing new ones. Thus, in its internal contradictions, it becomes an expression of the kind of ambivalence displayed by the well-known military historian Sir Basil Littlehart when he entitled his contribution to wisdom literature, "Why Don't We Learn from History?" and then proceeded to demonstrate on every other page that he actually believed that we would learn from history, leaving the nagging question of how man would come to do that which he had not learned to do before. It was answered only by a kind of desperate faith in the future. Well, time passes. We must not linger too long on the abstract and the general, nor list too exhaustively the evils of excessive abbreviation in dealing with complex subjects. Condemned to repeat it, you will have divined, does not mean, or is not intended by me to mean, that you must emulate the Saxon immigrants, even if you haven't paid very much attention to history. So unpack your bags or your space capsule. You have one more chance for 45 minutes. It does mean, however, that those who refuse to give attention to history sacrifice the advantage of information and perspective which it conveys. If we so equip ourselves, however, we can determine what we wish to emulate and what to shun of what has transpired before us, recognizing that the exercise of such discrimination invites a value judgment that is not altogether historically determined. Well, experience has its limits. The story of the Saxons, and in another way, the current history of our own church in recent times, illustrate the limits of learning from experience. Now, some problems are unavoidable, no matter how much history you study, simply because they are intrinsic in the situation. Harrowing as it may be, it is Scripture that condemns us to repeat the experience of facing attacks upon our faith and controversy within the ranks of the faithful. This is especially true in a confessional church. I need not cite the references. You can all quote the passages to yourself in your favorite translation. I'm forgetful of my audience. You can cite them in the original. Well, now, granted that these trials are not to be invited just because they cannot be avoided, Yet the attempt to flee from them or to find some formula for canceling them out is futile and potentially fatal. At this point, history offers no escape. Indeed, it reinforces theology. Even the Saxons might have known this much. Yet they tried the former, that is, flight, evasion. The emigration itself was for many, not for all, motives were mixed, an exercise in illusion, an attempt to escape the inescapable. Now, true enough, they could and they did extricate themselves from the toils of a state church. But in the United States of the middle third of the 19th century, that would be small comfort. They would not find respite from the assaults upon the essentials of the Christian faith. Emerson's Divinity School address, with its arrogant derogation of historic Christianity, was delivered within less than a year of the fugitives' arrival. Neither did their remote location save them. Missouri and neighboring Illinois were liberally sprinkled with German liberals of the Dreisiger complexion, whose favorite journalistic sport was Christian baiting. They enjoyed most of all poking sticks through the bars at old Lutherans. Nor was the country as a whole, particularly its West, known for piety or even for a high proportion of church membership. Most of all, the very spirit of the Saxon venture, the ambience of their exclusivistic social and religious life in Germany, their almost paranoidal sense of persecution, their escapist mentality, and the character of the tightly controlled and organized life they plan for themselves, these, to me at least, constitute the most faithful, the least distorted, and the most disturbing reflection of their dreams. The location farthest removed was the most desirable. The United States was chosen precisely because they thought that here they could come closest to isolating themselves. That was the conscious objective. The site of their colony was selected with similar considerations paramount, and the governance of that settlement that was to be founded was to be as thoroughgoing a theocracy as, to my knowledge at least, had ever been visualized for the United States, and possibly exceeded only once, but only possibly, when the Mormons, then still at Nauvoo, moved on to the Great Salt Lake. Saxonia in Missouri was intended to be a kind of Festung Lutherica within a Festung America. Of that, the codes leave no doubt. They are an important, fascinating, and highly revealing set of documents that deserve far greater attention than they have received, at least for anyone who wishes to understand Missouri Synod history. Let us hope no unfriendly psychohistorian turns his devastating attention to them before we get around to it. Subsequent developments shattered these expectations. The agriculturists and craftsmen of the Saxon immigration for the next 50 years, whom we gathered in, easily integrated in economic terms with middle-class America. But in theological terms, the mood continued to be one of beleaguered withdrawal rather than of engagement with the environment. The Fata Morgana of insulation in the New World persisted. The hope of silencing controversy within the church was even more illusory. Strife began inside their own ranks before they left and erupted within a few months of their arrival. There it became, for a time, endemic. Some took flight again, returning to the homeland. One made his way to Canossa. Some strayed, some stayed. For those who did, it was their finest hour. They fought it out among themselves. At the cost of some losses, they prevailed. At that, the consolidation of their position was only the prelude to further internal controversy within a few years, and external encounters of the theological kind for decades. It is difficult to see how it can be otherwise. Given our human fallibility, coexisting with a necessary respect for following conscience, in adhering to individual understanding of the word, that's a term that I use in an unbrechured sense, of the word, on the part of those who take doctrine seriously, divisions are predictable. History did not decree this. Theology does. Any effort at evasion on the part of the Saxons would have doomed them to repetition of the emigration. Any effort to defend their theological position to a repetition of controversy. Well, they stood their ground. For several generations, the church that they helped to organize faced up to the challenge, and it prospered. In these years, one form of escape was not attempted, namely the formula of peace through surrender. Synod neither rejected overtures to unite with others, nor did it join hands with those with whom it could not reach doctrinal agreement. For a time, it seemed, the lesson had been learned. There they stood. But the facade was deceptive. Insufficient attention to history encouraged false security, and pride incited distortion in accounts which passed for history. Internal strife and suspicion within the immigrant church, deep and protracted, was depicted as primarily associated with one man's personal qualities, could be made, and he could be made the scapegoat of Horse Prairie. The image of another leader was cultivated larger than life, purer than fact. The role of the laity was played down, and the stubborn persistence and error of some of the clergymen was largely suppressed in the interest of reinforcing their growing command of affairs as rulers of the roost rather than shepherds of the flock. Once more, Synod, now an Einwanderungsgesellschaft, in place of an Auswanderungsgesellschaft, became a haven rather than a staging area. Here was one place where purity of doctrine and adherence to the confessions could be taken for granted. Loyalty to the latter was admirable, of course. The notion that repetition and or insulation would produce such loyalty was preposterous. The decades marched on. The grooves of complacent assumption and false security wore deeper. What was happening in other American churches was seen and deplored sharply enough. But that lesson was unlearned, which a more honest and more frequent look at the historical landscape could have taught before their very eyes. It couldn't happen here, but it did. And when it did, the damage was aggravated by the fact that long after critical differences had developed among us, among other things on the matter of textual criticism, it simply was not believed by most of our clergy. A kind of cover-up was practiced by both factions. Now, the minority knew what it was doing, was served thereby, and they justified the dissimulation according to their own dim lights. The majority, however, cooperated because it didn't know what it was doing. It had great difficulty in coming out of the protective cocoon that it had fashioned for itself, in part by ignoring history, in part by distorting it. When the realization of what had happened took hold, the shock, therefore, was all the greater in many parts, because it had been regarded as impossible among us. The illusion of escape via institutional insulation in lieu of physical migration had been entertained for several generations. The neglect of historical studies during these years made a heavy contribution to this misconception and its consequences. A candid contemplation of history cannot remove the prospect of trials imposed by the human condition, but it can forewarn. Our church was taken unawares. Guess why? History and politics. A similar pattern of smug ignorance could be traced in considering a number of phases of our institutional life. I shall subject you to a few comments on only one more. Two perennial problems in an organized body of believers have to do with authority. The authority on which its theology rests and that which is expressed through its polity. Surely the Missouri Synod has been no exception, least of all today, when doctrine and government are both receiving renewed and sometimes startled attention. What I would like to talk about briefly, if I dare, and I usually do, I mean dare, is politics in our church's history. Now, to me, that's not a bad word. Politics is not only, but first and foremost, the process of exercising whatever power the body politic has, or the contest for such power. Not infrequently the former, that is, its exercise, is employed to enhance the latter. If there are no politics, you are facing a complete dictatorship. This is true even if you are talking about a church. The question is not whether there is something called politics in the church, but what kind. If you can believe there is nothing like that, or even that it is a marginal aberration from the norm, you can believe in pixies. You don't, do you? As for me, I have no faith in removing politics from our synod's operations by removing a recognition of politics from its history. Whatever you may think of the Ayatollahs, Saxony, Texani, Minnesotani, whom we have produced over the years, they have not achieved complete concentration of power. So we have had politics. From the word go, that is, let us go to America, we have been exposed to the forces that operate in this area, which is so suspect to the pure of heart. One could go down the line, step by step, and follow the trail from Dresden to 500 North Broadway. In fact, with the Saxons, we started out infected with a particularly virulent type of the political virus. The currying of the leader's favor long before embarkation, the dispensing of his favors to buttress his position, or probably more frequently denying such favors to discipline the recalcitrant. The concentration of financial control for the period of transfer and settlement. The exploitation of the larger contributors through a purportedly communal fund. The creation of an episcopal office and an hierarchical structure. The arbitrary exercise of the power of appointment. One could go on and on, but to no purpose. The fascinating fact about this facet of Synod's operations is the similarity of devices used in the theological and political spheres of operation to launder the linen of the survivors of the debacle. Again, in versions publicized over a century, blame was concentrated largely on a single subject and thus rendered removable. A complicity, especially on the part of the clergy, could not be denied, but was ascribed to the noblest of motives. And again, there is one. You will not be too surprised if I reveal that it was the same one, who fictionally emerged unscathed, who battles his way through Luther's writings to clear perception, firm foundation, and victorious debate. The laymen who first pointed the way are dismissed as troublemakers. The other pastors, who only belatedly and grudgingly relinquished their hierarchical pretensions when their hold was slipping, are treated in this period with a charitable silence. The better to rehabilitate them, my dears. All these representations are in an adversary relationship to the truth. But they were long nurtured and highly successful tools of political image-making that facilitated a reconcentration of power. Seldom, I think, has there been a finer demonstration in minuscule application of the adage, let me write the nation's history and you may write its laws. If we had been incapable of facing up to these political dimensions of our church's operations, we could at least have listened to others. It is already 16 years ago since Sidney Mead made the following statement about American Protestantism. incidentally, in a passage where he had only a little earlier referred directly to the Missouri Synod. So he was not unmindful of us. He wrote thus, "A powerful selective factor is at work in the choice of denominational leaders. Whatever else top denominational leaders may be, they must be denominational politicians." The emphasis, by the way, is Meade's, not mine. He continues, "Tocqueville was surprised to find that everywhere in America," and these now are Tocqueville's words, "you meet with a politician where you expected to find a priest." End of both quotes. Had we become used to recognizing the ubiquity of politics, we would have been less likely to be taken in by those who claim that the practice thereof began with the present administration, or perhaps it began with those who are responsible for replacing the previous administration with the present one. This ignores, among other things, the long years when Texas was the producer of Southwest Conference champions, American Airlines stewardesses, and Missouri Senate presidents. Greater realism in matters of this kind would make it manifest how during the 50s and the 60s, in an avowedly confessional church, its principal educational institution was taken over by crypto-revisionists. That is, it would become plain to all who do not cling to their belief that during all those years, faculty appointments were open only to men of suitably liberal mindset, and all this by special arrangement with the third person of the Trinity. This observation could with profit be extended to include all phases of the processes of placement, as well as other selected points where the Holy Spirit is mobilized to combat potential criticism of decisions politically influenced. A little less romanticism about the non-use of politics might even fortify us against the counsel we hear now that the only proper way to deal with those who treat synod's resolutions with disdain and defiance is to conduct heresy trials. It must not be done by just applying the rules. Somehow that is inappropriate. To give the cautions a practical application could make us wary of the suggestion that politicking is legitimate while electioneering is not. One is bound to hope that this notion is born of obtuseness rather than of more malignant afflictions. For it is a singularly perverse misconception. From history, we could learn that in representative government, electioneering is essential to the legitimization of politics. Furthermore, a little more sophistication about the nature of politics in large organizations would also make us much more sensitive to interference with the means of communication. When only official publications are legitimate, and all others are greeted with varying degrees of censoriousness, well, dissent is crippled. Discussion is contained because controlled. Manipulation of minds, rather than the stimulus of minds, has begun, and repression has put in its appearance. That, too, we could learn from our past. For the attitude has long precedent. The spirit has been there from the beginning. I learned about it firsthand in a classroom on this campus from one of the editors of the official organ of Synod. He met a suggestion from some young revolutionaries that certain subjects might benefit from a more open hearing with the curt dismissal, "The Lutheran witness is a pulpit, not a forum." And since, of course, all other official publications, such as the Theological Monthly, were at least as carefully censored, that was the end of it. Roma locuta, causa finita. It was a cozy arrangement that was supposed to safeguard orthodoxy and keep dangerous ideas from spreading. It worked, too, until the reins were seized by those whose fealty to traditional teachings and practices was, to put it circumspectly, open to question. We had learned more about politics in the Missouri Synod if we had faced up to the necessity, therefore, and if we had, therefore, learn to examine its execution instead of devoting ourselves to the pretense of its non-existence or its elimination, then we would have had a better appreciation of the task before us. For that task is to retain control of the processes in order to avoid being controlled. To cite Sidney Mead again, he is commenting on what he calls, quote, a movement that tried to recall denominations to theological and confessional self-consciousness, end of Mead's words. But that describes our circumstances, does it not? Now, such an effort, he reports, it was defeated in every major denomination, not so much by theological discussion and debate as by effective political manipulation directed by denominational leaders to the sterilizing of the divisive elements. Does it sound familiar? What then does inform our judgments in the task before us? It is perplexing to witness a body such as our Synod attempting to solve its problems without a thorough examination of its initial determinations and subsequent progress, or to assess its strengths and weaknesses on the basis of wishful thinking rather than analysis. This is less than one has reason to suspect from a group in which sufficient attention is still accorded the study of language to appreciate the Greek maxim, nothis auton. It is unlikely we shall ever understand politics in the Missouri Synod until we understand the government of the Missouri Synod. Unfortunately, we don't have a very sophisticated, well-grounded conception of that aspect of institutional life either. If we had a history or histories, the deficiency could be fairly promptly overcome. The basic information would be available and could readily be restructured to serve the analytical purposes of a particular situation or need. The only attempt, however, to my knowledge, that we have at doing a scholarly study of government in the Missouri Synod, a volume which appeared under that title, suffers from precisely this deficiency: an adequate fund of historical data on which to build. Now, this is said in no spirit of disparagement. Its author sensed the lacunae of information that plagued his effort. Indeed, it was his hope of remedying this handicap, at least for the formative years of the Saxon element, that led him to seek out a brash young fellow who, he heard, was digging around in the welter of material that then constituted Synod's archives. We became friends, and I had ample opportunity to savor his concerns. I wish Carl Mundinger were here today to reinforce my emphases, as I know he would. The copious narrative passages in his study betray the felt need and the imbalance of substantiating material between the early years, where it was available, and what should have been equally well-documented later periods reveals the gaps that he encountered. It is beyond me how anyone can pretend to understand the singularly incongruous architecture of Missouri Synod government without being thoroughly familiar with the stresses and conditions producing that inchoate compromise that determined its initial design. Enough may now be known to uncover those sources of incoherence, that is, the early ones, such as the dual principles of membership by pastors and congregations. But not enough, as research has been done, to spell out clearly how the Saxon experience and the vigilance of the layman in the early years receded into the background, this first arrangement flowered into a kind of fraudulent congregationalism, which is manipulated by local pastors, organizational apparatchiks, which is then finally directed by district and synodical politicians to suit their purposes at any given moment. The net effect, except for rare bursts of lay interest and perchance rebellion, is a well-entrenched clericalism without a clear and effective focus of responsibility on those who wield the power. Handy, but shamful. The basic problem is that we have a jerry-built edifice based on conflicting principles of membership, of organization, and of authority. Possibly it was the best that could be got out of an amorphous situation in 1847, but it has long outgrown its rationale, and this lag has damaged its usefulness. The issue, I suppose, in Lincoln's phrase is whether this church or any church can longer endure so conceived and so governed. Yet if we admit that we are caught with our scholarship down, what shall we place into the hands of our designates to lend depth to their insights? The Constitution of 1847? That Constitution is part of the problem. The Synodical Handbook? Well, one supposes that to be a part of their point of departure, but on a course guided by what compass? To appreciate the dimensions of the problem, just try to visualize yourself sitting down to write a centennial or bicentennial treatise on American government with the kind of fragmentary antecedent treatment of the country's history as we have of synods. I suppose we must plunge ahead, but reliance on instinct in place of information can hearten only the most anti-intellectual and vulgarian in our midst. The immigration took place under the sign of Jackson. It is the age of Jackson no longer. The gaps, attitudes as impediment. Now, these ideas about history and its significance for vigorous institutional life are not novel, not even among us. Yet for a long time, they received scant attention and less implementation in the Missouri Synod. It was not so in the very early years. At that time, we were active in constructing an image of our then more recent past. And if its product can scarcely be termed history, but rather demonstrated the self-serving uses of mythology, it nevertheless demonstrated that we thought at that time that we had a future and that we were bent on shaping it. But not later. Easier by far to erect statues or to knock down straw men, whichever expresses one's predilections. Mindful of the adage that he who controls the past controls the future, we appeal to our past even while being neglectful of it. Now, the sources of this incongruity can be found, I think, in the transitional generation between the immediate legatees of the immigration experience and the inheritors of the 20th century. The leaders of the first generation were the product of 19th century German universities. They may not have shared the prevailing spirit of those institutions, but they knew what those institutions were about. For more than a generation, these men and their students remained in command at all points. So we survived institutionally, but not, I think, at the same level intellectually. Deterioration was not the product of lesser intelligence, but of group complacency, especially when the first generation died out. The admiration for its key figures was so great that few thought to improve on their work. The job was to preserve it. We had become large, and we were still growing. Was that not evidence that what we were doing right? This reasoning, in turn, led to self-satisfaction with our educational system that made it more and more ingrown. Constriction of educational horizons was inevitable. Classical languages were stressed until sometimes these tools seemed to take precedence over the exegetical ends that they were to serve. German was no longer spoken by most, but was reverenced by synod's leaders. I can still recall that silvery-haired panjandrum of synodical heavies, President Pfotenhauer, addressing prep school audiences in the second half of the 1920s with ineradicable Hanoverian accent as, "Meine lieben Studenten." And off he was on an address which not one-fifth of his hearers could understand. Suggestions were not welcome. Brash, inquiring students were curtly informed by Milwaukee's president that our schools were in no need of accreditation by secular agencies. Its products were not expected to work outside our circles. Smugness was coupled with fear of contamination. After dismissal from these halls in 1935, as one of six students in a class of about 150 to receive a BD, I managed to enroll for graduate study at Washington University. Over the objections of the registrar that my previous education was inadequate. A few years after that, I learned what a mistake I had made in the judgment of establishment figures. For Synod's president at that time counseled the Lutheran ladies of St. Louis in public assembly that if their children insisted on attending a university, it would be better to expose them to the influences of the Jesuits over at Grand and Lindell rather than the unbelievers on Skinker Boulevard. If one wished to pursue graduate studies, languages, and perhaps classical studies were acceptable. But there were other subjects that were off limits and pursuit of which was regarded as evidence of moral turpitude. History was one of them. I should have known better. When I made that choice, there was, to my knowledge, not a single graduate of Concordia Seminary who had ever earned a PhD in history. Or if there was, he was never heard from again. The subject itself was subversive and carried a kind of disqualifying stigma. When I decided after receiving the M.A. in 1936 that I would rather continue graduate study than mark time in Kansas City on a district make-work project during the Depression, the seminary's dean informed me with an icy, blue-eyed stare and a jutting jaw, "Then we'll have to forget about you for a long time." Well, they did. In fact, they did until years later, I threatened to become the oldest CRM in the annual. Unwilling to grant me even that distinction, a zealous district president saw to it that my name was stricken from the rolls. It required, among many other encounters, well, better skip that. Studying history, our history especially, was both unnecessary and a breeder of mischief. It was unnecessary because we knew all the history we wanted to know. And why write more when we were daily repeating all that was worthwhile by reliving it? It was a breeder of mischief because it might destroy the approved past, bring to life a new one, and thereby render the legendary unrelivable. When years later, in the 50s, the result of the research in which I had been engaged for 17 years was published, the most titillating item about that enterprise for many people, even then, was how, in the name of unreason, it ever came to be accepted and published by an official arm of Synod. Well, I can tell you it was a close thing. If that offending volume survived, it was because those stupid laymen and those beschränkte Leutpriester out in the boondocks had more interest in their church's history than most of the theologian politicians who sat in the seats of power at headquarters. Of course, the Philistines had one more weapon, the silent treatment. Our church's official publications declined to sully their columns by paying any attention to the existence of such an offensive study, although the Mississippi Valley Historical Review, the leading journal for professional American historians, assigned it to Carl Witke, then regarded informally as the dean of immigration historians. Dr. Silflow stood tall on the issue with his personal support, professional assistance, and institutional exposure when the volume finally slunk out of the shadows. Synodical publications, however, including the Institute Quarterly, discreetly refrained from reviewing it, leaving that to professional journals, the organs of other synods, and the venomous columns of what was then Synod's obscure but leading reactionary independent publication. This sour and unreliable journal found it impossible to release its splenetic pressures in a single issue, so generously devoted another to the purpose. I mention these matters not to savor again a taste of alum that you may rightly suppose they brought to my palate at the time. Actually, to a native like me, it was more reminiscent of persimmon, a Missouri delicacy when ripe. These, unfortunately, were green. I was ahead of the persimmon season. I was grateful for my friends, embarrassed for the obscurantists in high places, mildly surprised that a resolution of censure did not pass the then Western District Convention, and a little regretful that intimations of a libel suit were not translated into profitable reality. Perhaps I should not detain you so long with these details. After all, they are history. And I relate them neither in rancor nor in triumph. By now, these episodes and policies are worth neither. I allude to them only because I think it must be difficult for you to become aware of how relatively recent, considered in the long history of our synod, these attitudes are, how deep-seated, how pervasive, and how lingering. They encompass biography as well, a genre that is often the child or the handmaiden of history. We don't have even a respectable biography of a single synodical leader for the past 140 years, judged by the standards governing such works today. We are not likely to get one if my experience is representative. After the appearance of the Saxon Chronicle, I spoke at the Orthodox seminary before it was transported to Philandia on the St. Joe. I opined that this institution might devote some effort and attention to the study of C.F.W. Walter from the historical point of view, that we could profit from an intensive study of Walter's career, including but not limited to his theology. The response can best be described as one of polar fervor. At the time, being much younger, but already having established my reputation for a reverence deficiency, I suspect that both faculty and students may have been afraid that I would undertake such a job. Well, they had no intention to encourage me to lay unholy hands upon Synod's memorial statuary. And so the result was a deafening silence. I was promptly spirited from the campus by the president with a minimum of fanfare. I was lucky he took me to lunch. Some years later, he became director of the Texas State Penal System. I must abbreviate. What is to be done? Plainly, two things. The history must be written. And secondly, who is to do it? And the answer is we must. We cannot entrust it to those whose patron saint is Pontius Pilate. We cannot entrust it to those who do not understand and hence cannot represent Synod's adherence to the confessions and its general position on doctrine for 140, or in the case of Synod, 130 years. We cannot entrust it to secular historians who would understand even less of what it was about. When my volume appeared, it was reviewed in the Christian Century by Carl Schneider of Eden Seminary, a respected colleague. In his flattering evaluation of the volume, he observed that it was an inside job, as he said, and then went on to observe more generally that as a rule, honest evaluations of this kind are best if they are an inside job. I think it must so be in our case. But in view of the other comments I have made, lest we become discouraged even before we begin in earnest, let me note our assets. First of all, the materials are there, at least the most of them. We have been more ready to collect the raw materials of our history than to write it. And that has been true especially during the last generation. Credit for the groundwork laid belongs, of course, to the Concordia Historical Institute, which is to say its indefatigable and irrepressible major domo, Dr. Silflow. I understand that his domo is about to become major, and I offer congratulations on this important expansion. Already he has squirreled away more items in that bulging archival granary than the Synod will be able to assimilate in a long, long time. Right now, its digestive tract is under no great strain because so little of this provender is being ingested into the institutional corpus. Secondly, and still with the Institute, the material is organized. This should cut by half the time it took to work piece by piece through mounds and drawers full of items that were stashed away in a classroom here during the 30s and the 40s, as Roy Silflo could attest. For that reason alone, I envy those of you who will use the resources now at our disposal and lying there waiting for you in orderly anticipation, languishing for your attention. The third, and in some respects the most promising piece of good news, is the changed climate academically that has developed in recent years here and elsewhere. Despite the reservations expressed earlier about some historical theology, generally, which you may have thought a bit dyspeptic, I am enthusiastic about what I have inferred from limited observation, mostly from afar, and now find corroborated in, to a great extent, here in attendance. Course offerings in history are tremendously in advance of what they were in my day and for a considerable time thereafter. Fact is, they do not deserve to be mentioned in the same breath. The range, the sophistication of the courses, their thrust and their variety confront you with a rich opportunity for laying the groundwork either for future graduate study or independent research. Furthermore, while I'm not personally acquainted with most members of your faculty, even in the field of history, professional qualifications, appreciation of our heritage, and potential for leadership for you in this area of historical studies are at an all-time high. This leaves only the question whether they encounter the kind of interest and response that will tax their talents from you. So far, I suspect not. While here, I must inquire about the precedent of graduate work that is directed toward the field of history. How much to the preposition in Hebrews, and how much toward the use of solar heating for parish halls in the northern Minnesota district? Have any of the avenues of exploration and the apertures for potential illumination that I have suggested today appealed to your imagination as worth investigation for their own sake and for possibly constructive approaches to contemporary problems? None? Well, then I bid you an affectionate and despairing farewell. Or even one? Well, that's fine. That's enough to make it worthwhile. Get a start. Indeed, you are better off than if 10 crowded in upon you. In that case, give up your guitar and get serious. Release your recorder and begin looking at the record. Do some historical research. Do it better than it has ever been done before. And may I live to congratulate you. But don't just not do it. Do not sit there collectively for the rest of your days as the historyless end of a church headed for good or ill into history. Most of all, do not pretend that you can escape it. As William Faulkner reminded us in Requiem for a Nun, the past is never dead. It's not even past. Thank you.
We are extremely grateful to you, Dr. Forster, and I think that the ovation which you have received is an ample demonstration of that. We are continuing to run a little behind, but in spite of that, I am sure that there must be many who have felt some kind of a sharp point that was jabbing the ribs somewhere along the line. And before opening the floor for discussion, and may I remind you that if you do have questions, that would you please use either one of these two mics, because we want everyone to be sharing in the question as well as in the answer. When Dr. Forster served the assistantship at Old Trinity in St. Louis, he became extremely volatile in his sermonizing. And I think much of that was in demonstration even this morning. And right in the second pew from the front sat a little girl with her mother. And after one of the great outbursts, she finally turned to her mother and she said, "Mommy, what are we ever going to do if he gets loose?" So I think with the references that Dr. Forster shared with us, there were others who were afraid that maybe someday he would get loose in Synod. But you have the opportunity now to ask questions, to probe more deeply in some of the areas that he has so very, very excitingly stimulated us with. Roy?
Dr. Forster, I want to express my personal gratitude to you for being here and my opportunity to hear you in this outstanding presentation. I don't think I have to tell anyone here who just heard Dr. Forster about the treat we had today. This is the best PR the Department of Historical Theology has had since I've been on board here. I'm only sorry that registration isn't tomorrow. But I want to say, Dr. Forster, I have always had a deep appreciation for the incentive and the kind of model for scholarship that you instinctively, without ever saying anything, shared with me when I was a student here and was the archival assistant and you were finishing the final touches of your research. Your model of scholarship has lived for me. And I tell you, we have had a treat this morning. There's also a note of tragedy here, which Dr. Forster only vaguely alluded to. The tragedy is that when we had a scholar of this stature emerging from Concordia Seminary, getting a PhD at a school like Washington University, that we never found a suitable opening for a man like this in the synodical school system. That is the real tragedy. Now, thank goodness, Dr. Forster, times have changed a little bit. I have found a person with a PhD from a school even further out than Washington U, University of Wisconsin, can survive on the synodical roster even after that kind of an experience and even serve in the synodical school system. But we owe Dr. Forster a real historical vote of thanks. He has been, as my brother said so fittingly, not only a trailblazer, but he has been an icebreaker in the real sense of the word. I thank you, Walter. This has been great.
Roy, you're much too generous, but I shall offer only two comments as a matter of caution to you. I would not set myself up. No, three. No, four. Well, I'd not set myself up as a model. I've already suggested that I was not circumspect enough. Dr. Charlemagne is a much better model. He went over to Washington and majored in classics and did well. I note that it even enabled him to address himself subsequently to some subjects other than Greek. The second one is that in research and writing, I am not a model. Don't let it take you 17 years to get into print. And, of course, I mentioned the good things in reviews. Whitkey's review in the Mississippi Valley Historical Review was very favorable, but you must improve on me at one point. He said, with eminent restraint, that the volume was undistinguished in style. But thanks, Roy. It was good to be here.
Yes, Dr. Forster. As a Christian historian, I was wondering if you would respond to the comment of another historian, a Will Durant, who in his book, Lessons of History, stated that throughout his study of history, he failed to find the presence of God.
I think it illustrates the point, and I had a somewhat longer passage in that. That's part of the problem. Twice as much as you can say in an hour. I think that is touched on, though, in my comment about people learning from history, what they are predisposed to learn from history. And this, again, reinforces my, I'll admit, rather circumscribed view of history. And you get beyond that, you're not in the field of history. You're in the field of the presuppositions with which people begin. And I don't think that anybody who approaches history with the preconceptions of the Durants is going to find the hand of God in history. And that's, I think, something that we need to learn. They even need to learn that in the district to which I referred. If, indeed, the key lesson that we can learn from history is that the hand of God is operative in it, I would not have wasted 1 minute of your time this morning. If that is all that is to be learned, then either you don't believe it, or you don't learn it, no matter how much time you spend. Research will not bring that kind of conviction. I think there are points at which the two can speak to one another. Of course I do, and I tried, however briefly, to indicate that. But the one does not underwrite the other. Therefore, if a theologian says the hand of God is operative in history, he is not speaking as an historian. And if a historian says history, or the hand of God is not operative in history because I can't see it there, he is speaking as a theologian, if you will, or a philosopher. He's not speaking as an historian. He's not even talking about drawing the lessons from history that can be drawn from it. Does that respond to your question?
Two questions. If I understood correctly, you attributed, at least in part, some of the problems we've had recently in Synod, first of all, to the fact that there was no established periodical for debate, open debate.
I think that's important.
How would, in what way, or have you given any thought to how such a thing might be established, edited, who might be in charge?
Well, for the first place, and that appeared more in my subsequent comment than in my initial address to that subject, I didn't say that it needed to be official. I personally, and certainly at the time when I addressed that question to Grebner back in the 30s, would have thought that the witness might do that. I recognize that there are limits to which one can go in opening the columns of an official publication to letter writers or article writers who are pleading cases for what Synod does not stand for. But you see, we have gone far beyond that. The reason that Theodor Grebner did not phrase his remark differently was because there were no publications of that kind. Look at today, when there are publications other than official publications. The establishment still doesn't want to see them, whether they have any responsibility for them or not. So I think that's an important kind of distinction to begin with. But even at that, I think we can stand more discussion. There is this kind of elitism, which, by the way, to me is in complete or in irreconcilable conflict with our doctrine of the priesthood of all believers, our derogation of medieval Catholicism's Kehlerglauben and the rest of it. I was a delegate to the 1959 National Convention of Synod, and while I sympathized in many ways with the complaints of restraint and too much constraint on the part of professors at the seminary at that time, even when I did not share the views of some of them, I was very unpleasantly affected by the elitism which they displayed. Their thesis was that if they had theological questions to raise, it was appropriate to raise them only with their peers. And when this cozy little crowd had decided what was official, then they would communicate the true word and presumably eternal life to the laity. This is the kind of thing that I find intolerable in our church as long as we profess the principles that we do. Or if it is a tolerable polity, let's change our principles.
That relates to my second question. You mentioned that one of the other problems was the dual standard of membership, both congregations and pastors. I see that you're referring to a type of ecclesiastical elitism infecting. How would you change church polity to remedy that and to eliminate the future possibility of more problems?
In the sense of having a kind of constitution for the Missouri Synod that springs out of my head full-armed like Pallas Athene from the head of Zeus, I don't have that. But, and aside from being facetious, I mean that. I think that the kind of political structure reflected in a basic instrument such as a constitution, which we have, is a very grave matter and must be considered from many points of view. Alternative structures must be carefully considered. But I think my main point today was that it has to make some sense internally, whatever it is. Now, whatever doesn't mean that I would accept any kind that might come along, but it also means that you could suggest two or three that I might accept if they did not doom themselves to ineffectuality and to conflict by the way they are set up. The comment, in other words, sir, was intended more as a caution against internal nonsense than it was as the launching pad for my particular view of the matter.
Okay, Dr. Forrester, two questions. Do you feel that Synod has progressed from its mythology to a point where it could do objective historical work of its own history? And further, do you think we are at a point in time that we have perspective to do history of the last conflict of Synod, or will that...
The latter words again, please.
Have we reached a point where we have perspective to write history concerning the last conflict Synod has been...
You mean within the past decade?
Yes, within the past decade.
The two questions, first one first, yes, I think that the climate has changed to that extent. Speaking with the candor with which I spoke to you this morning, it would not have been remotely possible within my lifetime. And I think, as I suggested, probably not for a long time thereafter. That kind of repression of a dissenting viewpoint, that kind of an open approach to discussion, that did not even survive, or that did not even prevail in the period before 1974 at this institution. But I think that our travel has made us more open to that, and that's why I'm a little concerned about the efforts that I see in some quarters, official and unofficial, to try to silence discussion and debate. Once more, however politically and informally, to reintroduce the old system where there are proved publications and the rest should really fade away. Well, they're not fading away. It's too bad that they should be given the treatment that they are, but it's much to the good that they are not being intimidated. 20 years ago, you wouldn't even have had them. The reason that Grebner did not say anything about that one independent publication put out at that time was because it was called, what was it? Confessional Lutheran, I think. Now, golly, you can't quarrel with that, can you? So if you want to have peripheral, and that was the prevailing view, that if you want to have unofficial publications that support the establishment position, that's all right. Now, you know how true that is. You can see it even today on the part of some people. Some independent publications appeared favoring the one view and were approved, and some favoring the other and were approved by that faction. We have got to get away from that. But yes, we've come a long, long way. Secondly, can we write with a sufficient degree of detachment about events which have transpired more recently, even very recently? Well, I'm in favor of trying. I think the principal qualification for doing something of that kind is not a 2 centuries remove. I think the qualification for that is the mental mindset with which you begin. And why doesn't somebody try it? There's one thing I can assure him. Subsequent research will evaluate it. I think you can be fairly objective about things to which you are very close. In the reviews that I got on the book that I wrote about the Saxons, there was no one thing that pleased me more. In all the reviews that I received, and it was widely reviewed, than the unanimity on the proposition that the book had been written with objectivity. I know that's a bad word in some circles. Historians aren't supposed to be objective. Well, as I say, let's not have them write our history. I know they're not. The only exception to that was the Confessional Lutheran, in itself the least objective of the publications that gave it any attention. No, I think it can be done.
Okay, one short one. Yeah.
If there was an issue or an era in our past history that you would see as the most important, which one would you like to see research done, I guess, in a hierarchy?
I'm not sure. If there were one area in which I should most like to see
research done as it would affect the church today, which would you have one suggestion or a minute?
Well, when I turn 10 pages there, I mercifully deprived you of a few remarks on this subject. I haven't thought about which one I would most like. The reason for that is that I think if we're serious about this, it's going to happen on a number of fronts at the same time. It will either happen sporadically, and not all those who out of their own initiative address themselves to the subject will focus on the same subject, so we're going to get a spread. Or there ought to be a cooperative organization of our effort because the hiatus is so very, very wide, we cannot possibly produce a history in the sense of having somebody cast himself bodily at this mountain of material and wait until he, if he does, ever emerges. Now, I'm not pleading for officially approved histories. May the Lord preserve us from court historians. But I think we need an advance on many fronts simultaneously. Maybe it sounds a little facetious to you, but now that you make me think about this, I'm not sure but what the best place to begin this kind of research would be with the last 20 years. Relates to the question which you answered over here. Because I think if you begin with the last 20 years, you cannot fail to see some of the very important points that I tried to make today. With what did we start? How was it handled? When did we decide that we didn't need history? And what was the result? An examination of these years would highlight every one of those problems and force you to go back. Yes, I think that's the place to begin.
That's a good place to stop, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.